Verse 16. Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Punaktu, Sahaviryam Karavavahai, Tejasvina Vatitamastu Mavidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Etadevaksharam Brahma. Etadevaksharam Brahma. Etadevaksharam Param. Etadevaksharam Param. Etadevaksharam Yatva. Etadevaksharam Yatva. Yo yad ichati tasya tat. Yo yad ichati tasya tat. Etat. He. It's a good, really nice cylinder. Etat, he, eva, aksharam, brahma. Etat, he, eva, aksharam, param. Etat, he, eva, aksharam, nyatva. Yaha, yet, ichati, tasya, tat. Okay. So, the previous, in verse 15, the previous verse, in the end, what Yama was saying, all of the Vedas are revealing which pada, which abode, all of the Vedas are revealing what all of the austerities, all the tapas, all of the austerities are talking about, desiring which all people practice brahmacharya. Brahmacharya here means commitment to this knowledge. Commitment to the knowledge, either living with a teacher, that type of thing, or practicing celibacy, or the vows of sannyasa, you know, or some sort of rigorous austerities of one type or another. Desiring which is as an aid to gaining the antakarana shuddhi, or gaining this knowledge. So desiring which, I will teach you that pada, that goal, that sthanam, that place, whatever, Brahman. Okay, I will teach you that in brief. Sangrahena means in brief. He says, Om iti etat. It is Om. Right? Om. So Om is really the most sacred syllable. The whole Mandukya Upanishad, which we I've taught most of now, not all of it, but that whole Upanishad is on Om, the meaning of the word Om. Any mantra that you recite always begins with Om. So Om is considered the most sacred syllable in the Vedas. So here he's going to give kind of a brief explanation of Om. And most people know Om. If you've studied all, you've all studied the Mandukya Upanishad. Om should be, the meaning of Om should be known. It should be known so clearly that when you say the word Om, it brings the whole vision, the whole Upanishadic vision into your mind just by simply saying this one word. Like say if you say the word tree, a tree comes to mind. You say the word lamp comes to mind. If you say the word jagat or world comes to mind. Right? That's the one incredible relationship between nama and rupa, the name and the object. Or the pada, the word, and the padartha, the meaning of the word. The knowledge, the word itself brings about the rupa, the manifestation of the word. Now if I said Swamiji will joke, and if you say something like gagubuga, okay, then what happens? It's like, well, what does that mean? Right? Because that word is not knowledge. It's not knowledge, it's a sound. Right? So then somebody says that and you've definitely heard the sound, but it's not knowledge. So when you say a word that has meaning, then the word evokes in your mind the reality that word is holding. It's an alambanam. The word is like an alambanam. Alambanam means it's something like a vehicle or a, what's the word I'm trying to think of? It's something that itself evokes the knowledge. Right? When you say it, it evokes the rupa. The Nama Rupa, name and form. So when you say the word, if there's knowledge there, it will invoke the Rupa. It'll invoke whatever is its nature, whatever is its knowledge. So now say, you say the word Om, and you know what the meaning of that word is. That word has been deeply unfolded. Then when you say that word, it's considered the most sacred syllable, because when you say the word Om, the whole Ishwara comes to your mind. It means the conscious being Brahman with the whole Maya Upadhi. You know, the causal body of just pure, you know, pure Maya in its causal condition and its avyakta, so this Brahman with the avyakta, the unmanifest causal condition of Maya. There's Hiranyagarbha, which is the subtle manifestation of Maya. And then there's Virat. There's the total physical form of Maya. So we call Ishwara. So that avyakta Maya, you know, that manifests as Hiranyagarbha, the subtle world and the physical world. So we call Ishwara. So Brahman is the self of Ishwara, right? It's the very being, the very truth of Ishwara. It's the very truth of the manifestation of this creation. And so when you say the word Om, if this word has been unpacked properly, has been taught to you, then what you recognize is that the Om, I'll just do this briefly because they don't do it very much here, I'll just do it a little briefly so that, just to give you that sangrahena, that kind of quick overview. The word Om is made of three letters, A, U, M. So the A and the U are called a diphthong letter. They make for an O. So O, the word O is a diphthong, it's made of A and U. So the word Om is A, U, M. Okay? The A is a full sound. If you just say A, everything is open. A, right? So that, the in terms of Nama, Om, and Rupa, everything is manifest. There's no constriction at all. Now if you say, and so that stands for Virat, means the whole manifest physical creation that I experience through my sense organs. It also stands for the Jiva in the waking state. So here, this is this is the waking state, and this is the waker. The waking state is the whole creation that we call Ishwara as Virat. His physical form is called of Ishwara is Virat. So Brahman with Maya in this physical form of the waking state is called Virat. The Jiva is called Vishwa, the waker. So there's Vishwa and Virat, the waker and the waking state. That's Om. There's constriction. So you can go it's totally open. Ooh, now it's constricted. That's the dream state. Right? That's the dream state. In the dream state, I am, if we want to get the broadest definition of dream state, it's when I'm not what I'm experiencing is not given to me, being generated by my sense perception. So even a daydream would count as the dream state. But we use the dream state because that's kind of the crest jewel of the because when I'm dreaming, and we can use dreams, the dream as an example, there's a subtle creation that you are experiencing. There's a dream character and the dream world. The dream world in Sanskrit we call Hiranyagarbha. Hiranyagarbha means the golden egg. What it means is that which is conscious being, like an infinite mind, like an infinite psyche that has a physical form that we call Virat. So Hiranyagarbha would be like the infinite subtle body of Virat. It's called Hiranyagarbha. And for you, your subtle body is called Taijasa. So Taijasa means the one who is shining. The Taijasa is going to be part and parcel of Hiranyagarbha, just like this physical body is part and parcel of the physical world. This is made of the same materials as the physical world. It's held together, it's held by the same laws as the physical world. And so this body really belongs to the physical world. And you can say, on the subtle realm, our subtle body belongs to the subtle realm. It's made of the same subtle materials and is following the same subtle laws. Like that. So that would be Tajasa and Hiranyagarbha. And then we look at the causal level. The causal level on the total is what we call Ishwara. Ishwara is Brahman, consciousness, conscious being, the Satchit, conscious being, with this Maya Upadhi. The Maya, Upadhi means conditioning agent. So Brahman with Maya, now we're talking unmanifest, is just what we call Ishwara. Ishwara manifests as Hiranyagarbha and Virat. So it's all, Ishwara is Hiranyagarbha and Virat, right? But Ishwara, in its most compact form, is Brahman, is conscious being, plus the Maya Upadhi. And the Maya Upadhi, that conditioning agent, manifests, you know, as Hiranyagarbha, as the subtle, infinite subtle psyche, which includes the individuals as part of it, like waves are included in the ocean, and that manifests also into the physical world that we call the waking state. So dream state, waking state, dream state, unmanifest condition, close more, is avyakta, unmanifest. So now if I say om, and I have understood this, the is going to evoke the physical creation, the the subtle creation, the causal, and then of course, this is what's so amazing, om rises out of silence, takes place in silence, and resolves into silence. Here's silence. First we start thinking like this, silence, om, silence. But in truth, the om rises from silence, is sustained by silence, and resolves into silence. Just as every thought you have, every manifestation that you have, every thought, every feeling, every image, every perception, takes place in silence, the silence of your being, right? That's why when we're doing japa, Om Namah Shivaya, we just say Om, Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, standing for Om Namah Shivaya, standing for any thought. The thought rises in silence, is sustained by silence, and resolves into silence. Otherwise, what if it was rising into noise? I mean, what if there's this noisy background, this blab going on all the time, and then there were these thoughts? The thoughts were, you couldn't hear the thoughts because of the blabber, right? But there isn't blabber. There's just silent being. And so you need to, we do japa, we do the japa to recognize that, first of all, the mantra is taking place in silence. So now I can recognize the silence. I can recognize that adhishtana, that which the mantra is rising and setting in, that is not rising and setting, right? The mantra takes place in silence and goes back into silence. And what we realize also is that actually when it's there, it's in silence also. So now, when we say om, there is a, which stands for all of the whole manifest creation, including coming into manifestation, being manifest, and going into unmanifest condition, all taking place in Brahman, having Brahman as its adhishtana. Adhishtana means the very truth, the very Satchit conscious being upon which this creation is dependent. And so this om couldn't be a more simple syllable, right? Om. But om is packed with the vision of the Upanishads, of every Upanishad, of every Prakarana Grantha, like Tattvabodha and Atmabodha and all of these explanatory texts. All of them are really an explanation of om. And so the more that these texts are studied, the more depth of vision you have, the more packed om becomes, packed with knowledge, right? Because it actually contains the entire vision. And so it's considered the most sacred syllable. So here, it starts out by saying, So in this previous verse, he says, I will teach you briefly, Sangrahena, you know, that which all the Vedas are teaching and all the tapasvis are talking about in terms of all the different forms of tapas. What all of the people are doing in terms of their brahmacharya, taking brahmacharya, you know, devoting themselves. I will tell you briefly what all the Vedas are saying. That is Om. And so now he says, and indeed, he says, Eted hi aksharam, and this very symbol, letter. Akshara is a letter, the letter. Okay. So this akshara, this very akshara, in this indeed, he is emphasis. This akshara is Brahman. Hence it's a nama. It's a letter. This letter, the symbol. It is Brahman. And then he says, Eted hi aksharam eva. The eva means indeed, right? Eva. It is Brahman alone, right? And it is this indeed, this letter is Param. So now he says, this letter is Brahman and it is Param. Now, why he says that is because the word, when we say param, the other side of the word param is aparam. Param and aparam. So since he says, first he says, this symbol is Brahman, and this symbol is param. What he's talking about is if I say the first one and then follow the second one with param, the first one is going to talk about aparam Brahman. Aparam Brahman is what we call, I'll translate, I'm just going to give you for those who want it, just a little Sanskrit. It's called Savishesham. Means Brahman with attributes. Brahman with attributes is what we call Ishwara. Brahman with the Maya Upadi is what we call Ishwara. Brahman, from its own standpoint, right, is what we call Param Brahman, or Parama Brahman. So now, let's just to make this clear, the creation itself comes into manifestation, is sustained, and goes into avyakta, unmanifest condition, right? Cyclically, from the standpoint of the Vedas, this is a Vedic vision. The creation comes into manifestation, is sustained, and then resolves. Into manifestation, is sustained, resolves. It is, when it's resolved, it's what we call avyakta. Maya has gone into its unmanifest condition. But that unmanifest condition of Maya, right, exists where?
What?
Where does it exist? All time and space belong to Maya. So let me just give you an example here. If I ask you to, like, pretend you're having a dream or an imagination, and I ask you to imagine a meadow, you know, imagine a meadow on a sunny day, you know, with animals walking through the meadow, playing in the meadow, and you're with your friends are walking through the meadow. So now you have this imagination. Immediately. It's not like, oh, how am I going to build that imagination? It's like, boom, it's there. Because we're using words that have knowledge, they're not like gaga-buga. So because you're using a word that you have knowledge of, the knowledge becomes immediately manifest as soon as you have the nama, right? But now, when it becomes manifest, what becomes manifest is time and space itself, and everything within it. Like, try to imagine a meadow without time and space. Imagine people walking through, let me say it like this, imagine taking a walk through a meadow without having time and space included in the imagination. Time and space and the five elements, space, air, fire, water, earth, and all of the elementals, are included in the imagination. And so in that way, when we think of Maya, what comes when from the avyakta state of Maya, there is no imagination, there is no creation. On a total level, there is no creation. Just like if you withdraw your imagination, you have withdrawn that creation. You have withdrawn the time, the space, and all of the elements and all of the duality that exists within that imagination. So now, thinking of Maya like that, when the creation comes into manifestation, time and space come along with it. When the creation goes into unmanifest condition, the time and space, plus all of the objectification that exists along with the time and space, go into unmanifest condition. Okay? So now we have, if we look at the cyclical nature of the creation, and the creation goes into an unmanifest condition, where is it located? Where is that creation located? Because you've withdrawn time and space. So now where does it exist?
Brahma.
Yes, exactly. And at the same time, what happens to Brahman in reference to this creation? For what I mean here, here's Brahman, just conscious being. Right? The silence in which sound takes place. That's why, in terms of the word Om, the silence in which the sound takes place does not modify into the sound. The silence remains silence. And consciousness, conscious being, remains conscious being when the creation becomes manifest and time and space come into being. And then when it goes into unmanifest condition, what happens to consciousness? Does consciousness modify into the creation and then go into unmanifest condition? We say, no, that's what the creation does. That's the avyakta of the creation. But the silence of Om is the nama, the name for the silence of Brahman, the silence which is conscious being. Conscious being is not making any noise. It's more than silence because it's conscious being. But with the nama, with the Om, right, this is a nama. It's a name. And the silence represents, in this nama, it represents Brahman. Because silence never is disturbed. Silence supports the continuum of sound silence. Sound takes place in silence, and silence takes place in silence. Relative silence. Silence which is relative to sound takes place in silence. Okay. Sound takes place in silence, and the silence between the sounds take place in silence. Silence is not ever disturbed. Right? So we can be looking from within the creation at the continuum between sound and silence. It's a lot of noise and it's quiet, it's noise and it's quiet, but all of that is taking place in silence. Right? And I am that silence. Consciousness is that what we call the very Adhishtana. And so now, say we start to understand that. When we say Om, what happens is I'm evoking my being as Brahman, I'm invoking myself as Brahman, and I'm invoking the entire creation, which is Ishwara. Ishwara is not away from Brahman. Brahman is the very self of Ishwara. Yeah? Brahman is the conscious being, the existence, the being itself, the Sat-Chit, in which the whole creation takes place, but which itself is never disturbed. Just like silence. And silence is never disturbed. Silence is powerful and a thing to understand, even in terms of your meditation. Swamiji, for new students, say, like he's giving a yajna or something, or some talk somewhere, he'll often do one of the first meditations as a guided meditation is to just listen to the sounds, just relax, listen to the sounds. They're taking place in the environment, like the truck horn I just heard, you know, listening to the sounds that are taking place. And then notice the silence in which those sounds are taking place. That's a subject-object relationship. There's a viveka there. There's a differentiation between the sound and the silence. That silence, the silence which is the what we call the adhishtana, the very support, the very truth of the sound and the silence, the one that is not interrupted by the sound. Right? The atma, the silence of your being is not interrupted by sound. Sound takes place in it. Relative silence is interrupted by sound. Right? But it was quiet and now it's so noisy. That's where sound is displacing silence within duality. But there's another level. There's another level, which is the sound and the silence are taking place in me, in my own being. So now when you say Om, if you, Om becomes a symbol that is totally loaded with your knowledge, the knowledge of yourself, the knowledge of Ishwara, the knowledge of the relationship between the jiva, the individual, and Ishwara. The whole thing is there in Om. So he says, this akshara, this symbol is what we call Brahma, meaning Apara Brahman. All of Ishwara, the whole Ishwara Upadhi, means the waking state, the dream state, and the deep sleep state. For Hiranyagarbha, for Ishwara, as well as for the jiva, the individual. And Brahman, and this Om, is also Para, Para Brahman, which is the changeless consciousness, in which is the very adhishtana, the very support, the very truth of this Maya, the very being which the Maya depends on. That's Para Brahman. Apara Brahman means the Brahman which is Mithya. Mithya means this manifest creation has no independent reality apart from Brahman. Brahman is the conscious being which is the truth of the whole creation. So that's why it's called the Supreme Brahman, Param Brahman. Apara Brahman means the dependent Brahman. Ishwara is, as soon as I say Ishwara, I'm including the Maya Upadhi. Maya Upadhi means this whole, the conditioning adjunct in the form of this whole manifest creation. That's Apara Brahman. Apara, because it depends on para. It depends on the para Brahman. So the supreme and the dependent, you can say like that. Yeah. It's not dissing Ishwara at all. It's just it's just saying that Ishwara, the whole Maya Upadhi, has Brahman is its truth, is its being. Like for you. Your truth, who you are, is not the thoughts that come and go. Right? It's not the perceptions that come and go. It's not the physical body that is continually changing and objectified. It's not dissing my body or my mind or my sense organs. It's just talking about it as aparam. It's not who I am. All of this, the truth of all of this is me. I am its truth. Like the truth of the pot is the clay pot. The truth of the pot is the clay. What is actually there is clay. It's a beautiful pot. There's nothing wrong with the pot. But what is putta is the clay. Right? It's the clay pot. So what about you? Who are you? Are you this body? Is this the self? Or is this body dependent on the self for its being? What about your mind? Is your mind the self? Or is your mind dependent on the self for your being? What about your sense organs? Are your sense organs the self? Or are they dependent on the self? We say they're mithya. They're dependent on the self for their being. Is your being dependent on them? No. Not in any way whatsoever. Your being is like the silence. The silence is what supports the sound. It itself doesn't become noisy. Conscious being doesn't manifest into this creation. It's the very being of the creation. And so that's why this akshara, this letter, Om, is Apara Brahman, means Ishwara. And it is indeed Para Brahman, which means Brahman, the very Atma, which is the infinite self of Ishvara. Etad hyeva aksharam jnatva. Having known this akshara, having known this. And having known it means what? Having known it as apara and para. Having known this whole, the truth of this whole akshara. What is the vision of the Vedanta? I am Ishvara. It's not just I am Brahman. It is I am Brahman. But when you say I am Brahman, you have to understand that Brahman, conscious being, is the clay of the pot. Conscious being is the very silence, is the very set-chit of the entire creation. So I can say I am Brahman, meaning that I am all of this. So if I say I am Ishvara, I also mean I am Brahman. If I say I am Brahman, I mean I am all of this. If I say I am Ishvara, it means I am Brahman. I am all of this. But if I say I am Ishvara, I'm acknowledging the creation as being my very myself, but myself being free of the creation. So, having known this akshara as para and apara, the one who, having known, yed ichati tesyatet, whatever that what he or she desires, they become that. Tesyatet. Now what that means is there are two as a Vedika, as a seeker, right? I can be seeking, wanting to know Param Brahma, wanting to know the truth of myself. Now, so having known, to know the truth of myself, I want to know Brahman, then that what is required for becoming Brahman is simply my knowledge, because I am that. It's simply knowledge, right? So for me to gain Brahman is not really a gain, it's a gain of the gained. To gain Parabrahman is a gain of the gained, because I am Brahman. You are Brahman. Ishvara is Brahman. There is nothing that is not Brahman. So to become Brahman is to know that I am Brahman, to have the direct, immediate recognition of my being as Brahman. That's how I gain Brahman. It's a gain of the gain, praptasya praptihi, right? But my drishti, I can also be seeking to become apara Brahman. To become apara Brahman, to become that, I have to do something. Because it's like the wave wanting to become the ocean. The wave can want to become the ocean by becoming the truth of the ocean water, and what does it have to do for that? So the wave wants to become the truth of the ocean, to become water. It is water, so it's only a problem of ignorance, that ignorance has to be removed. But say it wants to become, the wave wants to become the ocean. Now, that's not about knowledge. That's about a great deal of tapas and upasana and austerities in order to gain a certain amount of punya, tremendous amount of punya, to either be born in Brahmaloka, one of the highest lokas, you know, or to take the Hiranyagarbha sthanam, which is also possible through tremendous amount of austerities and punya, to take another birth where you're either going to be born into Brahmaloka or you're going to attain the sthanam, that identification with Hiranyagarbha, which most of us, that's not what we're doing. Nevertheless, when with this om, that's why the om is shreshta, we'll see in the next verse, it's the most sacred syllable. So it is the most sacred sound, because the upasakas, the ones who are doing meditation, you know, do meditation on om because they are seeking identification with Hiranyagarbha as an upasana, as the reward for upasana, which is an act. It's a manasa puja. A manasa puja means a mental karma, manasa karma. It's a mental karma that you're doing. to gain that sthanam, either to go to the highest heaven realm, you know, it takes all types of charity work, all types of fallen staying within dharma, all types of meditation, special meditations and tapas that you do, all kinds of things that are required to do that, to get that. It's a lot of work, a huge amount of work. Probably cannot do it. Okay. It's really way too much work for you to do. Okay, so anyway, but say you were to work and work and work and work and do all this, how many lifetimes? Anyway, you can do that. And so contemplation on Om as a meditation, as an upasana, can get you to that Ishvara sthanam, if you're in Nigarbha. Through jnanam, through dhyanam, it's a type of upasana, or through jnanam, knowledge, right? You recognize I am that. So both are there. See what I mean? So that's what he's talking about. Okay. Let's do the next verse. Continues on with this.
Etad alambanam shrestam. Etad alambanam shrestam. Etad alambanam param. Etad alambanam param. Etad alambanam yatva. Etad alambanam yatva. Brahmaloke mahiyate. Brahmaloke mahiyate.
So etad alambanam shrestam. Etad alambanam param. Etad alambanam jnatva brahmaloke mahiyate. He says, this alambana. Alambana means it's something that is going to hold something else. Sometimes it's just called a medium. This is this sound syllable, om, holds Brahman. Right? Just like the word rug, it becomes an alambanam for the rug. The rug is the actual rug is evoked by that word, so that word is an alambanam. So any word, in fact, is an alambanam for what it's holding. Okay? So here, this alambanam is the most ishreshta, is the most sacred. In terms of the different words in the Vedas, like the Gayatri and different chants and different things, they hold something very sacred. But of all of the alambanams and all of like the Hrim, Shrim, Hu, you know, all of these that we have, the sacred bija syllables and also mantras, Om is Shrestham. It is, cannot be, there's nothing superior to it. It's the best. I have it in my notes from when I was 40 years ago. Yes, it's the best, okay. Etat alambanam shrestham. He says, etat alambanam param. Means param also means supreme, because this alambanam holds everything. There's nothing left out. The whole Ishvara and Brahman as itself is contained in this alambanam. There's nothing more. There's nothing more outside of Om, right? So it is param. So he says, etat alambanam jnatva, and having known this alambanam, having known it, means not having known the word Om, but having known the word as an alambanam. That means having known that word so that it evokes the truth of it, of what that sound syllable is not just a sound syllable, it actually invokes your knowledge. So that jnatva, having known that alambanam, then he says, brahmaloke mahiyate. In the world of Brahman, in Brahmaloka, which is the highest heaven, he is mahiyate. He is adored. One becomes adored. But now, it's true in both. In Brahmaloka, as Brahmaji, or as the one who's identified with Hiranyagarbha, you are adored, become adored as Ishvara. Yeah. You're adored as Ishvara. As a jnani, you are adored. There's nobody more adored than Brahman. Because Brahman is the source of all ananda. What all beings adore is the ananda. The problem is, the ananda is always superimposed on different things, and so it's always dripping off those things. But why we go after this, or go after this, or go after this, or even go after different mental states, or going after dharma, or giving charities, or whatever beautiful things we do, ananda is always superimposed on them. You're not doing these things for misery, you're doing these things for happiness, for wholeness, for fullness. And because for a more sophisticated, or somebody's more sophisticated person, in the sense a person who has assimilated life a little bit more, a little more assimilation of life, you realize that it's really the more you love, the more you are loved. The more you care, the more you are cared. You know, the practice of dharma is what gives you joy. Not because you've decided for it to give you joy, it just does. Those are the laws. So you become more and more subtle and sophisticated in terms of your understanding how to get closer to gaining what you're really after. And just physical and sensory pleasure is probably the grossest level, the very grossest level of any type of ananda. Because it doesn't last very long. You know, things that are more subtle, like dharma or like your attitudes, have a longer lifespan. So you can relax, you have more control over it also. So you can relax much more. But what about when you know the very source of the ananda? It is that source of ananda that is adored, right? And so you can say, the way that you can look at this is, you become the most adored because you are what is most adored in all beings, because you are the self of all beings, and the self of all beings is ananda. You know, so if my being, if I am the most adored, it's not because you're all looking at me and adoring me. That's the body, mind, sense organs. But who's self is this? We say this, that myself, I become the most adored. It's because the self that I am is the self that you are. It's just that I'm no longer superimposing that ananda onto my body, mind, sense organs. Right? Then you could say, well, I adore your body. I adore your sense organs. I adore your mind. Well, not really. We don't really adore people, but you know, what we adore is our own ananda. We adore our own ananda. What if we were all to realize, I am that ananda that is adored? So I mean, I am. Each one of us can say, Tibius, all beings, I am the ananda which is the most adored. Hiranyagarbha is the manifestation of that ananda as conscious, the infinite conscious being, right, which is unencumbered, unencumbered, completely unencumbered. It's an infinite manifestation of ananda. You know, there's not the sukha-dukkha that takes place when you're identified with one aspect within that creation. But when there's unencumbered, the unencumbered self, that's Hiranyagarbha. There's no limitation. So that Hiranyagarbha is the most adored within samsara. Within samsara, within duality. So for the upasaka, the one who is trying to get the most that they can possibly get out of this creation, it is that identification with Hiranyagarbha or with Brahmaji and Brahmaloka. Because that's the most you can get out of the creation. But even that is finite. So Jnani is going to say, I want the ananda itself. I want to know the truth of all of this. Because Hiranyagarbha also comes to an end. That stanam comes to an end at the end of the kalpa. So But in either case, within duality for the upasakas, the meditators, that Hiranyagarbha is the most adored. For the jnanis, the one who seek param brahman, the ananda, the nature of the self, is what is most adored. Make sense? So now he's very briefly taught us about om. Very brief. So, but now he's going to really, the Upanishad's really starting now with the unfoldment of om. Without even talking about it anymore. He's told you what it is. It's everything. It's a name for it, the truth of everything. And now, verse by verse, he's going to unpack it for the rest of the Upanishad. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really something.
Wow.
Yeah. Beautiful. Okay, let's take it. Om swasti prajapyah parikalyantam nyayena margena mahim mahishaha go brahmanebhyah shubhamasti nityam loka samasta sikino pavantu kali varshitu parjanyah prithivi sasya shalini desho yamcho varahidah Brahmana santu nirbhayaha Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha Sarve santu niramayaha Sarve bhadrani pashyantu Ma kaschit dukha bhag bhavet Asato ma sadgamaya Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya Mrityorma amritam gamaya Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Hari Om Shri Gurupyo Namaha Hari Om.
Said that to gain this knowledge, it's knowledge of the self, knowledge of Brahman. Right? They don't say gain the knowledge of Ishvara and that is moksha. Is there a reason for that? Or what is it?
It's, well, maybe it has to do, and Rob has a question that's kind of like this, Rob, so I'm just making note here so you listen to it. You have to, like with the clay pot, the pot has to recognize, I am clay, right? The clay doesn't really have to recognize, I am the pot, in the same way. But now for us, here I am, well, because, well, just to make that clear, the clay pot relationship is the satyam mitya. What is really there is clay. The pot is there, we experience it, we experience the pot, but it has no being at all, free of no being at all apart from the clay, zero. So really the only thing there is clay.
Okay.
So here, the only thing here is Brahman. That's it. It is Brahman. It is non-dual conscious being. But here's the pot. Pretty big pot. this whole infinite display of this creation. But then now if you understand this whole infinite display here is conscious being. Right? That means this, one way we can say this, this whole infinite creation has a self. And it's not that it has a self, just like the pot doesn't really have clay. The pot is clay, right? So this creation, we can say it has a self, but kind of like the clay pot, itself is Brahman, right? The truth of this creation is Brahman. And so now we can say that this whole creation, therefore, has a self. So now what do we mean by that? Self, the self that you, who you are, your being, is self-evident. Your being is known without a knower. It's known because it is consciousness. So the is known experience of the self is not because there's a knower of the self, but because the self is self-evident, me, self-shining me by its very nature. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we can say that the self is known not because there's a knower, but because there is consciousness. It is consciousness. And then as the jiva, as an individual, I can say, and in fact, everything that is known is enjoying the knownness, which is the very swarupa, the very nature of the self. So all of this creation, we say this whole creation that we experience as an individual, the whole thing is known, whether it's my thoughts or my moods or my emotions or my imaginations or my perceptions, whatever is there is known. Because whatever is there is Brahman. Because Brahman, the Atma, the self, is known, therefore everything is known. I can't have an experience that is not known because Brahman is self-evident. And so now I usually, because of ajnanam, because of self-ignorance, I take myself to be me, I am here, and then I identify myself with all the body, mind, sense organs, and my eyes and sense organs become the knower, and these things become the known. And my thoughts, I become the thinker, and the thoughts become the thoughts of the thinker, and all of that. But actually, they're just vrittis, they're just experiences, all of which are known. The experiences that I identify as the subject are known. The experiences that I identify as the object are known. The knownness is me. And so now we say this whole creation, in fact, is Brahman. And it is known. Why? Why is the whole creation known? Because Brahman is known. There is nothing that is away from the is-knownness, and the Maya is a manifestation of Brahman. It has no being whatsoever apart from Brahman, and since this whole thing from its own standpoint is known, and from the standpoint of me is Brahman, it is known without nama-rupa, without name and form. Mm-hmm. From the standpoint of Maya, it is known, right? The nama rupa, the name and form are known. How are they known? How are the nama rupa, why is the nama rupa, the name and form known? Because of the knownness of Brahman. Right? But from the standpoint of Brahman, there's just conscious being. From the standpoint of the upadhi is known. But the upadhi has no independent being apart from Brahman.
When you say is known, then somehow to me that does imply a subject-object.
I know, but that's what I'm trying to, when I use these words, is known, and what I'm saying around the word is known, is what I'm trying to get your minds to do, is to recognize that the is-knownness is not dependent on a knower. But the is, see, what if I say is known, this is an experience we are having. Everybody can say, yes, this is known, this is known, this is known, okay? We know this is known experience. Now, I'm trying to use these words in such a way that you take off of the is known experience. Let that be the nature, the swarupa, the very nature of the self, which is independent of a knower. And so then what happens, if you can strip off the knower from the is-known, then what happens is what you recognize, that there is nothing apart from is-knownness. That is the very swarupa of Brahman. It's a completed state. So now you look, the whole creation is known. I'm just using the words is known to point to our experience in the world of this is known, this is known, this is known, this is known, this is known. Get rid of all duality, just leave is knownness. And then from the standpoint of this creation, Ishwara, the whole thing is known. And so then we'll say that Ishwara is a conscious being.
This Om, we pointed out that it rises in silence,
uh-huh.
is held by silence and resolves into silence. It sounds like the knownness, that this is known, is equivalent to the silence.
I would say like this, when you say the word silence, you're usually objectifying silence, the silence you're aware of in relationship to sound, okay? That's normally when we think, silence, sound, silence, sound. Now we're asking, we're pointing, we're using the silence of the silent sound to point to a silence that underlies that duality. To notice that there is a silence there in which the sound is taking place, which is not negated by the sound. Whereas in duality, sound is disrupted, silence is disrupted by sound, right? But we want you to recognize a silence which is not disrupted by sound. And that silence cannot be really differentiated in a sense from Brahman. When you get to that, there's no really objectification of it. It's just the nature of. You see what I mean?
So is that equivalent to knownness then at that?
Well,
point?
Then I would then, when you get to that silence, because there's still probably an objectification there, because I don't think of myself as silence. But when you get to the silence that is not that is not disturbed by sound, then you can focus on that silence, and we can use other words to puncture the what you call the vacharta, the immediate meaning of the word silence, and let that resolve into your own nature as consciousness.
So silence would not be a synonym for consciousness.
No.
In that case.
Uh-huh. No, but you have to. You use it to get to.
Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's something I have trouble with there too. Like the difference. I mean, it's a metaphor because we're not talking about like the scientific definition of sound and silence.
We're talking about our experience of sound and silence on this manifest level of our sensory perception.
Right. But then saying there's an underlying silence. That sound doesn't negate is a metaphor.
No. Well, no, explain more.
I don't know. I just like that doesn't make sense if we're just talking about it.
Well, what if I said like this? Consciousness is silent. There's no sound in consciousness. Consciousness illumines sound. Right. So then I could say there is no sound in consciousness. Consciousness illumines sound. No. And so now if we're using silence to look at the underlying silence that illumines sound and silence negate each other, but we're now pointing to that in that silence in which the sound takes place, which is not negated. So now we're going in, what is that? What is that silence? What is the nature of that silence which is underlying the sound silence where the... What is that? So now your mind has to, now your mind is not here, sound, silence. It's now wanting to know what is the nature of that silence, which is not negated by sound.
It makes total sense, except that it's not silence to me. Like there's like a duality there, and what is real behind that duality is consciousness. But that isn't.
That's true.
You know
but what
I mean?
If you, yeah, but what if you just said, does that consciousness
which illumines the sound and silence, is it itself noisy?
But it's not silent either, because silent is still like an adjective.
Okay. But, like, I could say,
is silence an adjective?
Well, I mean, saying something is silent.
Go ahead.
Let me try something. I mean, okay. What we're operating out of is a system of physics in this world. So it has materiality, time, space. We're using words built on that set of physics. And what we're talking about alternatively doesn't operate by that set of physics. So we're using words from one language to describe something totally different. And even when experienced, to try to then describe it, we're back into the words with this set of physics. So we're talking about silence in the form that we know it here. But the quality of silence, consciousness, knowingness, knownness, all of that, it isn't that kind of silence.
I actually wonder if it does hold up, though, under scientific silence, because you have this concept of noise canceling. And how does that work? It's basically removing the sound, and then what's left.
I mean, what I think of is it might be better or easier or more accurate to say that that consciousness that we're pointing to has no characteristics. It's without attribute. That can be a useful way of reflecting on it, because then we pull ourselves out of, you know, the use of this language and adjectives and descriptors. If we say it's without attribute, if it's empty, you know, to borrow from the Buddhists, that can be helpful.
Yeah, but see, that's fine. But I would say, like, this, you're again getting into trouble for somebody.
Yeah.
Everything you do is going to get you into some kind of trouble.
Yeah.
And so, because once you say empty is often equated with non-existence, you know? So the thing is, what I've found is that there are many what we call prakriyas. There are many different ways to get a person there. Some of them will work and some don't.
Yeah.
And then sometimes one that hasn't worked for a long time then works. Like that happened to me with, I can't remember at the moment what it was, but I remember that it happened. Something that Swamiji had been saying for decades. And I never even knew that I didn't get it. Amazing. So it's like I didn't hear it as something to be heard even. And then all of a sudden it's, wow. And I knew, I remembered that he'd been saying it for as long as I've known him, but I never quite got it, you know? But the problem, like the problem you're up against right now, is that this word silent or silence is not something that, with the way that you hold that word, is not something that is working as what we call a lakshana, something that is pointing to your own being. Instead, it's acting as an obstruction, because that word, your own conditioning around that particular word is stopping that word from working.
Yeah.
But I don't think so. I think I totally get it. It's just that trying to use an example in samsara to illustrate something, like, that's always going to be tricky. But what I don't understand is, if it doesn't, to me, it doesn't even work. It doesn't even really make logical sense in our world, I guess. That's my problem with it.
Yeah, you've got a problem with it. So for other people,
of course it doesn't.
For other people, that sophistication around the use of the word silence is not creating an obstruction for them, and so the word silence easily resolves into the consciousness. But for you, it's going, this is not correct. Because you have an understanding of silence that's not going to, that is separate from your understanding of the self.
Well, don't all these words are just mere pointers? Isn't that
they're
how you
pointers,
approach
but
words?
You have to be careful. I mean, this is the tricky thing with teaching. You know, sometimes they work and sometimes they don't, and you have to just keep trying to make it work for your students.
Yeah.
Barry?
Well, I was just going to weigh into the idea of physics, and maybe this will help you think about it. When I studied tabla in India, my tabla guru, you know, explained that Om is the universal note. And I began to see that, and especially later when I studied physics, some of physics, that it's all about oscillating waves. Sound or silence is indifferentiated from what, you know, the connectivity of the whole universe. But,
yeah.
You know, this whole loka is just a kind of amalgamation of oscillating waves, then there is no difference between what is silence like. There's an increase in frequency, and then we hear a sound because the wavelengths are, you know,
yes,
waving faster, and it hits our ear in a certain way. But then it could smooth out, but it's still oscillating.
Yeah,
so
but
there's
in that, that's the dichotomy between silence and sound.
Yes.
You're still in the wave world. The waves are negating each other, or they're not, but you're still in that same order of reality.
Which is?
Between sound, where sound and silence are.
Where sound happens, so to speak.
And so does silence. Silence happens and sound happens. But we're talking about something that is not a happening, but it's just the nature, non-dual nature of being itself.
Mm.
And there's no oscillation. Any kind of oscillation is going to belong to Maya. So all the waves, all these frequencies and all this, that's all going to be a quality of Maya. Because there's change involved.
Mm.
Right? And so the sound, silence, even though they're all coming by different combinations of waves and waves, negating waves and all of that, you're still within Maya. But what if there's a silence that has nothing to do with the waves? It's just being itself, which is the very substrate existence that allow the waves to have any being. So it's a different order of reality.
That's how I think of the reality, that there is no sound, no silence. It's continuous.
It's continuous, and there's never sound or silence.
That's how I understand it.
Yeah.
What did you just say?
Continuous has a sense of continuing on, whereas for me, if we use the word continuous, it wouldn't be like continuing on, it would just be the natural state of being that's free
right.
of sound.
Contiguous.
Yeah. So it's just a matter of, like, continuing, I would have to talk, we'd have to get our, make sure we use
right,
the same
right.
thing about these different
right.
words and things like that.
Well, don't they say that Dr. Murthy teaches in silence?
Yeah, but,
you know. Okay.
So I have two questions. One is inspired by this, but what Rosa, at the very beginning, she used the word metaphor. And if I understand the word lakshana correctly, a metaphor can be a type of lakshana. And if it was okay for her to think of it as a metaphor and that solved the problem, it seems like it
How
would
is metaphor
be okay.
kind of lakshana? Give me an example of that.
Well, if you, a metaphor is an example, can be pointing to something. You know, it's not a direct pointer. It signifies something other than the direct meaning of the word.
Like the pot and the clay?
Like the pot and the clay, that would be an example.
Yeah, okay, but that's
and,
not
and
lectiona. That's
I know,
not
that's
lectiona.
A,
okay.
I know it's not.
Okay.
But
those are called the drishtantas, which
right.
are very important, like the pot and clay, the wave, ocean. There's many different, the tenth mantra, these are all drishtantas.
I just don't have a lakshana coming to mind, and that's why I didn't pick that.
Well, the
silence is a lakshana.
A lakshana is the basic meaning of a lakshana is something that defines the something that in a way that is unique to that thing. That's really a lakshana. And it's very hard to, and within duality, to have a lakshana is very, very difficult because it can only be applied to that very thing.
Wow.
So the lakshana really...
Oh, I misunderstood that.
But there's more to it. Yes. The lakshana. For Brahman, there's two types of lakshana. One is called swarupa lakshana, and that would be Brahman is consciousness, which is existence, which is infinite, satchitananda. There's nothing else that can be that. That can't be applied to anything other than Brahman. That's Swarupa Lakshana. There's what's called Tattvastha Lakshana, where the Tattvastha Lakshana is pointing to something, and that's the only thing that it can be pointing to. It's not the thing itself, but it's pointing to that and to nothing else. That's called Tattvastha. Like, if you had the example is if in a Brahman village, you know, all of the houses look exactly the same. If you look down the road, there are like 50 identical houses, one after another. And so somebody wants to point to their friend, there's my house. Well, which one is that going to be? So he says, it's the one with the bird on the chimney.
Crow.
The crow on the chimney. Yeah.
But doesn't the silence, behind the silence, do exactly that? Uniquely point to Brahman?
Yeah, which one is
the people
once more? Well, that's interesting. Uniquely point to Brahman. I mean, if you can make it point to Brahman, it depends on what you mean by point. Like,
in the way a pramana points.
Maybe in the way that... Well, that would still be... That's a little bit tricky because of this. In your mind... When you have the experience of ananda, right? Like some joy or happiness or bliss, kind of the positive spectrum. That is different, quite different, than the ananda that is the nature of the self. Right? But we would say that the mind, when the mind is in is quiet or has a shantavritti, that quiet mind as though reflects my own nature. And so it's very simpatico, it resonates with me. Even though when I recognize my own nature, it is quite different than the different types of ananda I experience in my mind. So that's an objectified ananda, but it's kind of like a reflection of the ananda that is my own nature and which is completely resonant with my being. But for my being, that ananda never comes and goes, and I can have a dukkha vritti, suffering, and that same ananda is still there, right? So it's quite a bit different. So we would say that that ananda acts as a lakshana, as a pointer to this ananda that is myself. But it is different. But when we're talking about silence, when we're looking at the differentiating sound, silence, that silence is different than the silence of my own nature because that silence is disrupted by sound, right? It's on the same order of reality. But I can still use that silence to point to the silence of my own nature. But in pointing to the silence of my own nature, I am recognizing a silence that is not subject to disruption. And so we would say that, so what I'm saying here is that I don't believe there's some underlying silence that is underlying the silent sound dichotomy. That silence is my very nature. That consciousness itself, not that consciousness has the attribute of silence, but that there is no sound or silence in consciousness. And so consciousness is, by its very swarupa nature, by its very nature, silent. Yeah. Not because it has a quality of silence, but because that duality is not there.
Wow.
Got it?
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Can I ask my second question?
It's where no, it's where no sound can occur.
Yes, no sound can occur.
Yeah.
Not possible. No, because no duality is there. The second thing is there.
An approximation, a metaphor, or whatever the heck, illustration. I haven't been an astronaut, but what I imagine is if you're in deep space, thousands, millions of freaking light years away from anything else, and your eyes were closed, you wouldn't hear anything, and there wouldn't be anything to hear. Hearing would be, there's no possibility of sound. There's no air for vibrations to occur. So it would be an utter kind of silence that could not be broken.
Except
your own
that you would be aware of that silence.
Yeah.
And so there's a duality there.
Right.
Yeah, the body makes noise.
Okay, let's let Michael do his thing and then we have to stop.
Yeah.
Okay, so I've asked this question, or a related question before, but you kind of touched on it in answering this. So there's this Ananda.
Ananda.
I'm saying the A, but it's just not loud enough. So, but I'll keep working on it.
No, I mean, it's awe, not it's not Ananda. It's Ananda.
Oh, okay. Ananda.
Long one.
Ananda. And so there's the Ananda, Ananda of our being. And you said this time that then it's qualitatively or
different
from the little Anandas out there.
Well, the little Anandas, I mean, the different type, they're not little, they're little and big and huge and
right, but
multi and varied.
Okay, the
experiences of happiness and joy and pleasure and
how
bliss
can it be that there's a difference between them? If the very self of all those.
Because what your experience is a vritti. You know, like if you go to a fun house and you look into one of these mirrors, you see 100 different versions of yourself, right? Because it depends on how the mirror is concave or the way the mirror is fixed, so you see. Just so, why do you have a whole different display of emotions, let alone the happy ones? You have so many different experiences of different versions of happiness. Not just one. You're happy, happier, happiest. You know? So there's many different, in the spectrum of emotion, there's many and varied types of happy emotions and many and varied types of miserable emotions, unhappy ones. But the Ananda is something that is present in every single one of those, not just the happy ones, but in the unhappy ones also. But you like the happy ones because they're more simpatico, more resonant with your own nature, even though they're different. You like say now if I have having a happy thought or something, I'm not thinking, oh, that's so different from me. I'm not thinking like that. You know, I'm just enjoying it because it resonates so much with myself. But myself is equally present in the dukkha vritti, in the unhappy state.
I guess I'm curious how that works.
Okay, well let me just try. This is an experiment you have to do. You notice your own self when in the times that you're happy, just, you know, gently focus on your own being. That's a really beautiful meditation. There's times when you feel happy or joy, just like we do in meditation all the time, when I say just gently turn your focus to your own presence, do that. And then when you're just neutral, your mind is just neutral, gently turn your presence, your mind to your own presence. When you're in a dukkha vritti, gently turn your mind to your own presence. And see if you can recognize the one who is the same.
That actually makes sense, and I practice that. And even when I'm in a bad mood, I practice it, and it's like, wow, this is amazing. But I just don't understand how it functions, you know, that, like, I want to understand the way I have some knowledge of how a car runs. It's not complete, but I have some sense of it. Like, how does it work that a banana that's really ripe tastes so good, and then, but so does chocolate, but they're different. You know, And they're both things okay. that colloquially.
Okay, but we can't. We're not going to do bananas and chocolate.
You can put whatever you want, broccoli. And...
No.
Okay.
We're talking about the keep with the emotional spectrum.
Okay.
You keep with the emotional spectrum, then you can look at the emotional spectrum going from relaxation, deep relaxation, that we call shanti, to stress. And we have names for that, every point along that continuum, you know. But the self isn't participating in that continuum. The self is always the same. So then the question would be, understanding the continuum in terms of going from stress to relaxation and back, from heaven to hell, like that, and then differentiating that continuum from heaven to hell, happiness to sorrow, differentiating it from your own being, which is ananda. And now you have to say, what is that ananda? Because it's not a point on the continuum. The ananda has a different meaning that you have to recognize by recognizing your own self. Does she have something?
No, okay. I was just happy to see her.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes she has a
so voice. So she might have.
Yeah,
she seemed happy.
Yeah.
She's having ananda. Are you distinguishing like pleasures from anandas?
I'm distinguishing
like physical things like eating.
Yeah,
or...
yeah. The ananda is what is yourself, which is ever present.
Right. That one, of course.
Yeah.
Yes. But it sounds like you're saying we're talking about emotions and spectrum, and think of that. Don't think of physical. And
just
to make it easier to explain, or is there
makes it easier to explain and
okay.
If say food brings you a lot of joy, you know, then which it does me too, all good food. But say now you have a banana that you really love, okay, so now you've had the banana and you dip it in chocolate, now you really love that banana.
Double ananda.
Double ananda. But then just gently turn your focus just to your own presence and you say, what's the relationship between my own, when you turn, gently turn your focus to you, what is that ananda? And what is the ananda that my mind is enjoying? And just keep making that differentiation.
Banana meditation.
Yeah, the banana meditation. To recognize what is the constant there. And why do we call that ananda? Why does the Shastra call it ananda? You have to figure that out. Right? Like right now, if you turn your attention to your own being, why is that me? Why is it labeled as ananda? It's, you know, because you're probably not in a bliss state at the moment. You're just yourself. So why ananda? That's a beautiful that recognition is very freeing.
Are we finished?
Yeah, we're finished.
Thank you.
My pleasure.